How often do five passing words, uttered by one acquaintance to another, turn a normally brief encounter into a decades-long business relationship of mutual respect? That's what happened to me more than 20 years ago when I first met the very talented Catherine Hamm, then an account executive with the WUSA's Washington Freedom, one of the eight teams in the first Women's Professional Soccer League. Though I'm a straight man and Catherine is a lesbian, this episode's conversation provides more proof that as equal members of the human family, there are certain outcomes all friends yearn to find, embrace, and celebrate. Hey, this is Rob Cornelis. Thanks again for joining me for the Game Face Execs podcast. And if you have recently read my book, The Sales Game Changer, How to Become the Salesperson People Love, you're going to love our guest today. Because in that very first chapter, I tell a story right at the outset, and that story involves my guest today. Her name is Catherine Hamm. She is someone that I have long admired, respected, and I've wanted to have on our podcast ever since we began. And so, Catherine, finally in 2021, welcome to the Game Face Execs podcast.
Thank you, Rob. So glad to be here. It's fun to have this little reunion.
It is. And I've had many people comment to me about that story that I tell in the book, and they want to know more about you. And so I was tired of telling them myself. I thought, you know what? Let's just get Catherine on the podcast.
Let's make it linkable.
Like you say, it's a great reunion. You and I first met, we think it's about 20, 21 years ago.
Yeah.
We were in a different place in both of our careers. But let's go back. I was working with a women's professional soccer team called the Washington Freedom, where you were a leader.
Yes.
Take it from there. Tell us how you got into that job in Washington, D.C.
Well, I will say that professionally, it was a window in time that was one of the most fun jobs I've ever had. I had been actually working in independent schools in the Washington, D.C. area in the lead up and experienced some burnout at a school and was looking for something new to do, something different, something to take a break. And my wife and I were season ticket holders of the Washington Freedom. I played soccer my whole life. I went on to college to play soccer. So the same age as a lot of the girls of summer, the 1999 class, and I wasn't as good. So my career had ended. And yet there was this entity that I felt very passionate about and connected to. And I thought, boy, you know, why don't I just send in a resume? I know soccer. I love being a part of it. It would be such a tremendous honor and pleasure to support this team and to support women's professional athletics, which when I was a kid, like that wasn't an option on the table for us. It just so happened that the day that I sent that resume in, they had just happened to let go an account executive. So I got a call from the sales operation just saying, look, we've got this position. This is an entry-level position. It might not be your deal, but if you'd like to come in, we'd love to talk with you about it. As it may be obvious to your listeners or anyone who follows soccer, one of the fun pieces is I had just the right last name since our marquee player was the great and incredible Mia Hamm. So I like to say that I played right cubicle while she was out scoring a lot of goals and was really the just penultimate player and just such a wonderful asset for the club and for women's soccer, obviously. See,
I always thought, Catherine, that you got her a position on the
team. Is that how it went? Maybe. Maybe. I'm sure that I must have set up just the one shot that she needed to make to advance to the national team or something. Anyway, it was so much. I had so much fun. And that is what led me to meeting you was the league was looking to, I think, enhance and develop and support the skills of its county executives. So we all loaded up into our cars and headed down to North Carolina. And you were running a workshop on sales. And I'm a total dork. I love to learn. I love to sit in class. Like I was one of those kids that thought school was really fun, both for the academics and the athletics. So to sit in a workshop and get skills that were new or were being taught to me in a different way. And I was a young, just as you were young, Rob, I was a young professional at the time. And so it was really great to get this sort of concrete articulation of skill set to help me do my job and hit my marks and so on. And so I remember it well because you're such a fabulous storyteller. You're such an energetic teacher. And I was completely enthralled by the educational opportunity. And obviously, the anecdote, which I was surprised and pleased to find in the start of your wonderful new book, I do remember talking with you after, and I remember feeling really moved and connected to what you were saying and teaching us.
there was a mutual connection because obviously during the workshop, which lasted a couple of days, as I recall, you were always very engaged. You asked great questions. You challenged me. And then when you came up at the end and we said our goodbyes, thinking that we, of course, would meet again, work again together. And what you said to me, and I'm not going to steal my own thunder. I want my listeners and viewers to read that first chapter.
Yes.
But what you said to me just opened up for me a whole new perspective of what I do for a living. And so I've been forever grateful for that. And as I say in the book, I've shared that story numerous times to other clients. Mm-hmm. And when they hear what you said, they all just kind of nod affirmatively, like, wow,
that's
she's
so cool.
Insightful.
Well, I said, must be our chemistry and dynamism, because it was something that was very clear for me. It was organic in that moment. It felt like a light bulb moment, which are I love those moments, right? I like them more when they're comfortable, which your workshop was. I like them less when I feel like it's like blood, sweat, and tears and lots of kicking and screaming to get through it. But I love those light bulb moments that provide suddenly insight, you know, and just literally like turning on a light switch and it sheds light, which helps everything you're doing next be that much easier.
You know, Catherine, I have to ask you, though, regarding your start with the Washington Freedom, mm-hmm. which is, of course, the league did not last too long, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. It's since been reconstituted now. Mm-hmm. But you went from education. Mm-hmm. You were in the classroom. Is that correct?
I was a counselor, a coach. And at that point, that last job, I was actually a high school administrator.
Okay,
so I taught, but I was doing a little of everything in the school side.
So for many of my listeners, sales, the whole topic, even taking a sales job would be the last thing on earth they'd ever consider doing because, right, they're not, quote, cut out for sales. I'm interested to know what was going through your mind coming from an administrative position, from a coaching standpoint, to accept the idea that, you know what, I'm going to take an account executive position. I'm going to become a salesperson. I mean, most people, you know, won't touch sales with a 10-foot pole. So for you, what happened? What was it just, hey, this is something I've got to do? It's a necessary evil to get to something better? Or is it something you actually aspired to?
Yeah, it's neither or none of the above. There are two parts to the answer. The first around what I was doing was, as I was just saying a minute ago, like really this was an extension to participate in something that mattered. This was really part of being a member of a team in a sport that I cared about and something I wanted, which was professional women's sports. Again, we forget how much it's changed in such a short amount of time, but there weren't professional sports. I was a young kid who was just a sports junkie that grew up in a time where my sport wasn't in the Olympics. It now is. And we certainly didn't have an opportunity for professional athletics as a choice. So to me, this was a piece of that story. So that part just was really easy. I was like happy to do whatever. I'm sure part of my comfort with something that involves sales might be connected to that I was totally that kid in your neighborhood. If you live in sort of a suburban neighborhood situation where the school was asking us to do a readathon or a swimathon or a whateverathon, and I was like out there to go and raise money. So I was the kid that nobody wanted to see coming because while I did come trick-or-treating for candy, which was the easiest exchange we had, I also came to your house asking for you to sponsor me. And for the families who underestimated the number of books that I would read or the number of laps I would swim, sometimes we had to negotiate what the donation would be. So I guess I'm fortunate and being an extrovert and just seeing as an opportunity to be connected to something that's meaningful, to me, that's not sales. While I understand your point and I, from what I've read in your book so far, I think you're dead on right. And it just, to me, is that's not sales. It's really being connected to something, to a mission, to an opportunity that's meaningful.
Well, when the league did fold, no fault of yours, Catherine Hamm, but when it was not in the cards at that particular time, as I say, women's soccer has resurrected and is doing very well in a variety of markets, more markets than the original league enjoyed. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, when the Washington Freedom folded for a time, you obviously had to move on professionally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you've talked already about following things that are meaningful to you. Mm-hmm. So where did your career go next? Because I'm assuming you were not looking for a paycheck. you were looking for something that was meaningful to you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So can you describe that path for us?
Sure. And I would say that it's by the time I was in my third iteration of a career, from education to working in professional sports to working in the wedding industry, and we'll talk more about that, I realized as I was reflecting on what is this common thread, that I was always connected to something that had some connection to social justice. So the education, the teaching of kids, the supporting women's professional sports and bringing empowerment for women and girls to the forefront. My mom started a business in 1999 called twobrides.com and also the companion site twogrooms.com. And it was an outgrowth, a response, her response to struggling to find products for my wedding to my wife in 1999. Not legal. Those were the days of commitment ceremonies. And it was a time that there were commitment ceremonies certainly happening and there was a market to be served, but there weren't really companies embracing our community and other ways serving couples who were looking to have ceremonies and celebrate their commitments. So my mom was in the early years of having just launched that business and needed some support. In the course of the things that I have done professionally and as a, just as a person, I love things that involve marketing, writing, sales, strategic thinking. I'm a natural entrepreneur in a lot of ways. And certainly I want to help my mom and I certainly want to help her launch a business that is really groundbreaking and of which I felt so proud of her and which I saw a need for. So I joined her in 2004. I started helping a little bit part-time. And then in 2005, I became a full partner in the business. And that's the time in which we actually acquired and rebranded as gayweddings.com. And we're really moved from being a boutique where we offered products for folks planning their weddings to actually much more of a comprehensive resource site so that people could come and find vendors and vendors could find couples. And this is really what moved me into the wedding space. So relatively quickly, I found myself referring to what I did as I'm a gay wedding expert, which I just find is hilarious. It still makes me laugh to this day. And truly, my expertise and where I have spent a substantial chunk of my time is as an LGBTQ wedding expert, working within the wedding industry, trying to support couples, trying to support wedding professionals, and otherwise trying to shift this space. So lots of fun stories that we can talk about within that. But I would just say to you that I found my way accidentally into it. And yet, hindsight always being 2020, I can certainly see the path and understand quite clearly why it was a great match. And I let me just add one more little thing I did along the way was I had gotten a master's in social work when I was teaching. So there is a piece of clinical work and communication and thinking from a community organizing standpoint. There were some ways in which my graduate level studies were also really well connected to this business opportunity.
Well, I don't think it's too unusual that an entrepreneur would, if you will, fall into a business.
Yeah.
We've often been told that you should follow your passion. But if I look around the world and see successful entrepreneurs, with apologies to those who have been able to turn their hobby into a career, most of us, and I love what I do, let's be clear on that. You love what you do. But many entrepreneurs do what they do. They start the business they do, not because they're passionate for that particular product or service, mm-hmm. but because they do see an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
There is perhaps a void in the market and they want to fill that void and they recognize that it would be financially fortuitous if they did. And so more power to them. Mm-hmm. In your case, as I'm hearing it then, kind of two things collided in a good way. They intersected, perhaps is a better term. You do have a passion for social justice and for social issues. You had a mother who is in need of your expertise mm-hmm. and abilities. And then, of course, you had probably the desire to be your own boss. Is that a fair characterization?
I do tend to like to be my own boss. Yes, that's true. It was so, actually perfect timing to solve that. What am I going to do next? Who am I as a professional? So absolutely, it fit the bill to help me figure out the question of what's next.
So I have to ask you on the need that your mother initially saw, and she was working to fill mm-hmm. at a time when gay weddings were, as you say, more ceremonial than official. Mm-hmm. At that time when you joined her, had you already gone through the experience yourself or had that yet to come?
Right. So this would be my wife and I had our wedding, which we called at the time a union. Language was still evolving, and what we were doing was relatively, again, new. We got married, had our wedding, our union in 1999. And I would say that to this day, that is still the ceremony that we celebrate, even though we've since made it legal. So I had actually been through the process and understood what some of the challenges were, not just from saying, hey, we're going to do this thing, but we actually planned a wedding and encountered wedding professionals, understood what our challenges were, recognized how hard it was in making choices to say, here's who we are and will you help us? Which literally what was happening at the time, because any phone call could lead to just a hang up or a polite decline or some unkind words said. And again, just rolling back the clock for anyone that can go into the 90s, it was not, a lot of people weren't out. We didn't talk about LGBTQ communities and families in the way we do. We were often closeted at work. We weren't all ready to get married. And many folks in my community didn't even see weddings or unions. I think such a beautiful relationship, an important relationship statement and ritual, didn't even see that as a possibility because it wasn't anything that was part of what our experience could be. So that's a whole other topic that I'm incredibly passionate about, and it has certainly changed my life. But the shorthand context of it was that I came out thinking I was making a choice where my family may reject me, and marriage, which is something I'd always imagined I would do, and having kids, that's not an option for me. But this is who I am, and this is what it is to be authentic and true to myself, and feeling like, wow, there may be these costs to accept that truth and to live authentically.
I'm reminded as you're talking, Catherine, about a gentleman who has since passed away, who was a dear friend of mine, and his name is Dennis Richardson. Now, Dennis Richardson was a politician in the state of Oregon, where I used to live and work. He was a state legislator when I first met him. Eventually, he became Secretary of State, which is essentially a lieutenant governor, second in line, if you will, to the governorship of the state of Oregon. And he fought against same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. And many people, you know, his followers, those who are of that ilk, they fought hard against it. And you've encountered many people in your life and in your career who at one time were maybe political enemies. But here's something, the reason I bring up Dennis is this. I was so impressed with him. After gay marriage became legal throughout the country, he was asked a question during his last campaign, a question on television. Hey, you basically lost, Dennis. What do you think about that? Mm-hmm. And rather than digging in his heels and saying, well, the Supreme Court made a bad decision and those types of things, I was so impressed with the grace in which he answered the question. He said simply, I congratulate them. Mm-hmm. I congratulate them that they now could enjoy marriage like my wife and I have been enjoying it for years and years. So I just want to say that because you and I, we've talked about this. You and I aren't the same on every issue, policy, but there's a mutual respect. We kind of belong to the Mutual Admiration Society, you and I. And I love that about you. And I hope that's true, what I just said, but it is, that's the way I feel about you.
Yeah.
I have to ask you though, some of the hardships that movement has experienced, can you give me some insights? Because I'm not in that constituency. My wife and I have been married for 34 plus years. So I don't understand the things that you've lived through. And perhaps you can give us a little bit of a peek into the issues that you faced back then versus perhaps today. How is it evolving? Is it better in your world? Is it still challenging in your world? I would just like to learn from your experience.
Sure. Thank you, Rob. And yes, mutual fan society, for sure. what I would say is, too, that when you use the phrase political enemies, maybe it's because I live in Washington and we think about politics differently. I live in an industry town and my wife is a nonpartisan analyst. So there's just a different way we approach this. There are definitely people who I might have policy disagreements with. But I feel, particularly in my work and when I was working in the wedding industry and trying to support folks and understanding why this mattered, approaching things from a standpoint of, are we enemies or friends? I mean, maybe it's just kind of how I am. It's not how I roll. And I also find it doesn't really serve a higher purpose of how we take care of each other in our immediate communities, our families, or our broader city communities to our national community. So I'd love to try to answer your question really just through my professional experience. It's one of the easiest ways to tell that story. And I think it's one of the things that, to me, it's so intriguing about watching a group that has largely been disenfranchised, sometimes treated unkindly, sometimes in still being on the receiving end of hate crimes and losing jobs, losing housing, not having access to medical care, losing family, struggling and accepting a parent's love or receiving that. The wedding space, it was very interesting because the whole conversation is about love. You know, being LGBTQ identified isn't really that different outside of being straight identified. You're a person who has feelings and has connections. I think one of the differences between when I was coming up versus today is it was a rare a parent who would say, hey, I see you and how can I help you? And are you interested in boys or girls? Many kids growing up today, they are given the space where parents aren't already, they may have a preference for what they want, but they aren't setting the table in a way that means there's a course correction down the road. There are ways to be more inclusive in general in language so that the kid can just be who they are. And just to give you a personal example, which my parents know that I use this example, is that not long after I came out to them, one of them said, you know, secretly, we were afraid it was true. And, you know, I was a young person, but I was still like 21. So I was relatively late coming out. But while the parent side of me and the compassionate daughter side understands what they were saying, there is a deep part of grief I have about that because it asked me, or I asked myself, my God, what years were lost? Because if you understood this about me, in what ways did you unconsciously or without intention help to construct a reality that you hoped for me, a way that I might be or what my life should look like? And if there was a truth that I couldn't really articulate, but that was speaking to me from a place of my heart, and it's hard to describe, but understanding who I was, then what did I lose in that process? So just fast forwarding back into sort of the wedding industry and conversations I've had with a wide variety of wedding professionals, event planners, photographers, caterers, like you name it. There are also one of the most interesting groups to speak with would be officiants, some of whom are religiously affiliated, some of whom are not. I was involved in this. I mean, this business my mom started was the first of its kind. So we were really the first in having this conversation. In the earliest days, the wedding professionals who wanted to advertise their business and find same-sex couples, very few, some were like just happy to be out there with it. The majority were like, I want to do this. I'm open to it, but I don't want people to know because I'm afraid of what I'm going to lose. I'm afraid of the business I'm going to lose. I'm afraid of the clients I'm going to lose. I'm afraid of what people are going to say to me. So the work in those early days was helping folks to actually understand the opportunity. So there may feel like there's risk, but recognize that there is goodwill. There is feeling aligned with your values. There is an opportunity to have customers who are going to be really happy about the choice that you made to serve same-sex couples. And then as the tide with what was happening from an advocacy standpoint, from a legal standpoint, the tide really began to turn and people felt much more comfortable. I framed it to folks like, your wingman has arrived. Like, you're not going to be the one who's standing out there alone doing this. You've got an industry saying this is okay. And one of the things that as an educator and consultant that made a big difference for me was I had a national company, Wedding Wire, which now has acquired The Knot and is known as The Knot Worldwide, had me on their main stage front and center teaching what I had to teach about understanding same-sex couples, understanding LGBTQ folks and what they might need. And when you have the validation from a nationally accepted brand, it changes the game further. And for those who still feel some fear or feel afraid or aren't sure what to do, it helps bring the temperature down. So I had this interesting perch as a business owner and as an educator and a person who personally was invested in this, watching how opinions really changed, comfort level really changed. And one of the things that made it easiest was we were talking about love. Because when I spoke with, I think, for example, some professionals or officiants who had some fear that were grounded in some of their religious teachings, it was very easy actually for us to find some commonality around doing unto others as you would have them do unto you, around love and respect and relationship, that there is actually plenty of both and to be had in the conversation. Now, I don't mean to be too Pollyanna about it either, Rob, because many days it came at some cost to me, because I'm sure you and your listeners might imagine, I've had some things, people say some hurtful things to me, that I was good enough as an educator and as a listener, that they weren't recognizing that some of the questions they were asking and things that they were saying were deeply dismissive, were hurtful, were very less than. I would just say it was in my commitment to say, I want to have this conversation and figure out how I can help you understand me more, which helps me hang in because I understand that you're afraid. How can we continue this conversation? Because I think there's plenty of room for me to get married and for me to support love, commitment, all these values that I know most religions are about at their core.
I obviously cannot, and thank you for that, Catherine.
You're welcome. Thank you for your question.
I obviously cannot anticipate the questions that my listeners and viewers may be having right now as they're listening to our conversation. So perhaps you could identify or even predict their questions better than I can. I'm sure you. So can you help me understand, what are some common fears or questions people have about your industry, the gay wedding industry, that you have had to overcome, or that if you had a chance to speak one-on-one with them, and when you do, that fear is quickly overcome, or it's never realized because they have more information, more insight from you. Can you give us an example or two of things that you've encountered along the way?
Let me think about that while I answer this first part, which is, I went from being in the gay wedding industry, which it was actually more of a niche market, I would say, into the wedding industry. So one of the things I do professionally now is I'm a wedding pro for the Knot Worldwide, which means I provide education and support, which is really built around marketing for small business owners, which many wedding and event professionals are. And I like to talk more broadly about inclusion. And obviously the LGBTQ community is part of that story, but there also are so many other non-dominant groups, if you will. And oftentimes that's non-white, for example. In the wedding industry, it might also be non-female. So many of the men who are really routinely sort of disenfranchised and shut out from conversations are brought up to believe that weddings are about the bride or the woman. They're not about the couple or about him, which I spend a lot of time talking to wedding pros about. So, you know, in some ways, the question you're asking is really about the old days. So much has changed. And, you know, I went from my first wedding conference where I said what I did, and like this woman who was based out of Richmond literally turned on her heel and walked away from me. She couldn't even tolerate the audience I said I was looking to support, to really being greeted and people very excited to tell me about a wedding that they've worked or a friend of them who's gotten married or something that they're doing that is really cool. And we actually just exchange tips around, how can I work on the marketing practices in my business? What are the relationship things I need to be aware of? How do I work through some of these sort of, I guess, cultural competence is a general framing I use, so that, in other words, we try to do as much as we can to know what we don't know so that we can be more open and available to support the client who needs our services. And maybe they found us and maybe they haven't. So for me these days, it's much more broad than that. Now, that said, service refusal was, you know, a really big contentious issue. And I would suggest that even with the marriage equality legislation that passed in 2015, the service refusal question was really sort of a can that got kicked down the road. And so I would say to you, Rob, I don't have an answer about that. And I mean, just quite personally, days of more grace and space to hold the conversation than others, depending on how tired I feel, because it feels like we're in the place of, and this is, I think, sort of an American construct of, somebody has to win this fight. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that we've come up with the creative solution to figure out how we provide space for everybody. Because the bottom line is, something that is true that same-sex couples still wrestle with, certainly not in larger urban areas, but in certain smaller towns, for example, or some areas, they may say, hey, I'm looking for your services for my wedding. And the vendor will say, no, I refuse to work with you. I don't believe in same-sex marriage. Now, we can talk more about really embracing and upholding where folks come from in that. And there is a piece of, this is what my church tells me. This is what our community believes and supports. This is what I've always thought. Maybe it's linked to, I'm afraid of what might happen if I question this, or I'm curious about it. What I have come to find is, never assume you understand what someone's reasoning or motive is. But in the end, it's really hard to be someone who comes in and is like, I'm looking for flowers. And someone says, no, your relationship doesn't count. So as an LGBTQ identified person, as someone who has a wife and we have a son who I don't want to know that there is this stuff out there, right? I mean, he does know, he understands it, but the thought that there would be this one side detail about us that might lead to being refused services or told we're not enough or we're not okay or we don't count, which is how it feels, just speaking personally, it's hard. So I just would say, I guess maybe jumping ahead to where the question is, and it's the unfinished business, which is about service refusal and how we coexist and how we empower each other. And how do I feel about that today? Today, with the last few years of what's been happening, I think it's even harder than ever because I've seen people circle up wagons and we have lost communication. We have struggled to find the bridges. We have struggled to build relationship and to listen to one another. We've struggled to remember the art of compromise. I think there is a responsibility for those of us who are in a dominant identity group. So for example, me being a white person, how can I approach my relationships and understanding what the experience is of someone who identifies as Black or African American in our country? How do we provide space if someone feels disenfranchised from an institution or a community or a belonging? And I want to say that, you know, we're in an era where this is hard work, but this is the work. So thank you for the time to answer that. What I would say is there is a piece of advocacy, or some might say sales, in that there's a piece of relationship building. There's a piece of engagement. There's a piece of, I don't know, how we get to the end of the conversation together without hanging up on each other.
Well, and another side of this discussion for me is the anticipation that there will be families that are coming together in a union. And let me just use a simple example, which may be stereotypical in nature, but one family is more traditional, as you might say. They may have religious beliefs that are very ironclad. That's admirable. There's nothing for me, there's nothing that should be dismissed about that. I value and myself am a traditionalist, as it were, when it comes to religious beliefs. The other family, for example, though, may have more of this free spirit, if you will, where we want to make it up as we go. We want the ceremony or the union to really reflect the persons who are being married rather than the perhaps the institution of marriage, if you will. So I'm asking you as an expert, how would you counsel individuals, families that are coming together because of a marriage who may have different viewpoints on how it should be executed?
Yeah. You know, it's a really interesting question, along with the setup to it, which there feels like there are a lot of bunny trails that would be really fascinating to talk about. I want to say that in the shortest point from A to B on that would be my experience and what I've come to understand and what I really valued about my wedding and that ritual. I'm a big believer in ritual. I think ritual matters. The question I heard you asking is, does the institution get to determine the ritual? Does the family get to determine the ritual? Does the couple get to determine the ritual? Or does another family get to determine the ritual?
Yes.
I've talked to a lot of straight couples who, when they tell me about what's been hard about their wedding planning or what they wish was different, was the ways that the family engaged and fought and laid in expectations. And I realized when I heard a few couples sharing these stories with me that one of the great benefits and opportunities I had in designing essentially a same-sex wedding, designing a wedding with my wife, was we had to figure out the ritual parts that mattered most. What is this union about? And while we've developed shortcuts to represent sacrament, for example, this was a level of, we have had an opportunity to build one that would be ironclad, I think, in all of what a permanent lifelong union and commitment looks like, but that we built it around who we were as individuals and, but informed by our own experiences and traditions and understanding of why some institutions might introduce certain rituals. So really a lot of same-sex weddings often look like a greatest hits of various religious wedding traditions, whether it's the stomping of the glass to a father giving away a child to who officiates and what the language is around who is bearing witness. So I would say, and you know, Rob, if some of your kids have gotten married, you've wrestled with some of this question. And my counsel generally to the couples is to listen to what you folks have to say, but to remember that the union, that the ceremony is about you. In my day, parents didn't even know what to do, and they certainly weren't paying for it, so there was no tension, right? Whereas if you're a couple that says, hey, we want to do it this way, but one family is like, hey, listen, we're paying for it, so we're going to do it our way, I just would say you're not really having an authentic, meaningful conversation that's about what really matters. you know, that gets into family communication, that gets into what the couple wants. I would even challenge the couple. I think sometimes couples rush to the altar too quickly. And certainly in an era where we spend less time in communities and institutions that might support how we consider lifelong commitment and what that means, we get too fast and that creates problems down the road. So this is the social worker in me, right? There's a multifaceted answer to that. And I can't really give you a one size fit all outside of to say as a professional, I tend to lean in protection of the couple because I think it is a universal issue that comes up for all families.
I recognize my question was broad and every couple—
It was just perfect, Rob.
Every situation's idiosyncratic, isn't it? And there's so much nuance to it and personality. So I appreciate your answer. And I think it's very fair. Now, let's turn to Catherine Hamm, the businesswoman, the business owner. You're in the wedding industry. And as I understand it, the pandemic really did a number on the wedding industry.
Yes. Yeah. The hospitality and services industry, it's for a relatively resilient and constant industry, it's taken a big hit. That is for sure. I'll say that I actually have done less consulting and have been less involved. I still do a little bit, particularly around small business consulting, but haven't been under the hood in the same way that I was before. In 2008, we struggled economically, and it was very interesting. That was partially with the rise of popularity and openness to same-sex weddings. So at that time, there was a way that there was this interesting economic storyline around this market that was interested and had dollars to spend because there was pent-up demand from couples who hadn't yet gotten married. I don't know yet how this is going to turn out for the services industry. There are a lot of folks who do this part-time, and I'm not sure that it would be sustainable for them. It may be that there's a whole new batch of young professionals who enter it because they lost their other jobs. And I think there is a difference if you're an officiant, if you're a wedding professional, if you're a photographer. For the folks that are in catering and in event rentals, it's very complicated. And I think that from a standpoint of people who are just looking to think about the bottom line, it's going to be really challenging. I would say as someone who thinks that weddings quickly get, I may get in trouble for this, bloated and are more expensive than they need to be, I think this is a beautiful opportunity to help people get back to basics on what weddings are all about. I really believe that a wedding is organized from the ritual, the ceremony, and out, not from the reception, and then you do the rest of it. So that comes from my experience specifically as an LGBTQ person. It is about my belief in, as a social worker, around ritual and thinking about spaces. I think it's wildly unpopular with a lot of folks, but this is one thing that I hope becomes a good change. I want the very best for all of my colleagues in the industry. And also, I want weddings to have meaning. I don't want them to be just empty exercises in money machines. That's not the work I do.
I haven't told you this before, Catherine, but I have one of my sons is among his many talents. One thing he does on the side is he captures weddings through video. Now, I recognize, and he does as well, that everybody who has a camera phone thinks they can do that.
Yeah, that's right.
So, but he is a real artist. And
that's fantastic.
And one of the things that impressed me most about his work in this last year was how he was able to capture the intimacy of these very small scale weddings with the couple, perhaps their parents, maybe siblings at most, and of course the officiant. And it was just, they were beautiful videos, stories that he was telling through video that your earlier point, you don't necessarily see when there's a reception of 500 people.
That's right.
So
That's right.
So tell us a little bit more about the other consulting that you do, areas of expertise that you have. I know you're certainly an author. We didn't talk about the book that you wrote about wedding photography. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that. And then I'd also like my audience to know what you're doing today. What is capturing most of your attention today?
Yeah. So I would say much like after my days with the Washington Freedom, I've been in a period of trying to figure out, you know, what is it I do? I think you'll appreciate this, Rob, too. I was just reading chapter 2 of your book and it occurred to me like, oh, wow, this describes intuitively some of the process that I've been going through. But that is trying to understand who am I and what is it that I bring? What is the value proposition that I bring? And I found it really hard to define what I do because it's so many things. So the three categories that I've come up with are educator, strategic thinker, and partner in empowerment. And I end up doing that in any number of domains. I'm on a board of trustees for a school. So I'm interested in doing leadership work that's very strategically oriented. I do a lot of small business consulting. I've been doing some mentoring with folks who might not otherwise have had the same access to resources that I did as a young person graduating from school with no college debt, for example. And with the network I have, how can I help promote and support them in achieving their entrepreneurial dreams? I do a little bit of consulting in the wedding industry as a wedding pro through the Knot Worldwide, as I mentioned. I'm a parent. And I do some work supporting my wife and her business, which is a little bit of a Jill of all trades, sort of support for her. We've got a couple things cooking I think will be interesting in the new year. But what I realized was in this interim phase, as I was doing less in the industry, I needed to explain to people, if you want to work with me, what does that involve? Or if I want to answer the question, what do I do for a living? How do I answer that? So I would say that it is both a work in progress, and yet what I understand is there is still a connection to social justice. I'm very interested in diversity, equity, and inclusion work. And I now have had some corporate clients that are interested in having leadership-oriented conversations around cultural competence, about recognizing their blind spots, about figuring out how can they be efficient, responsible, ethical business owners, which I just love. So that's a little bit of the value of being a little older, you know, is feeling like part of it is I have some wisdom from the various hats I've worn and having the opportunity to connect with people that are interested in engaging in conversation around that.
You talk about being a little older. You don't look older, Kat.
Thank you, Rob.
but I am interested in that comment because hopefully with age comes wisdom. I'm interested to know the difference between Catherine Hamm of 2021 and Catherine Hamm of 2000 when we first met. What would you tell the Catherine Hamm of 2000 if you could speak to her today that you've learned, that you've experienced over the years?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think there would be different nuggets of advice from the concrete to the general. As you can tell, I love themes. And what I would say is at that time, I would have benefited from understanding a little more of how to engage more deeply in my listening to understand experiences outside of my own. And I would have also been aided with an understanding of how, I think I always knew that adversity could be an advantage, but what I didn't understand was how I was collecting all these different experiences and relationships and professional moments and challenges that would actually come together and lead to the next thing. So one example, you referenced my book, The New Art of Capturing Love, The Essential Guide to Lesbian and Gay Wedding Photography. You know, Rob, I've loved writing my whole life. Love it, love it, love it. As a kid, I was like writing journals. I was writing poetry. I loved my English classes, the whole nine yards. There was a part of me that always wanted to write a book. Like, I just thought that would be really cool to be an author. And there is no way that I ever would have thought that what I would be writing would be a book about same-sex wedding photography. That just would have struck me as completely cray-cray. There's just no way. And as it turns out, my social work degree, my experience as an educator, my involvement in the wedding industry, my ability to recognize what small business owners needed to help them, my desire to make a difference, my desire to support marriage equality becoming something that we just stopped thinking about or arguing about and accepted as an opportunity for dignity for all couples to participate in these unions, it was a natural. And I don't think in 2000 that I really would have understood that possibility. I mean, and again, I wouldn't have believed you if you'd said I was going to be in the wedding industry. I would have thought that was crazy. So I think part of it, one of the things that's helped me is I delight a little more in what the universe provides in front of me. And I look for what is it that sparks my interest and passion and feels like a connect that it's time to show up. And here's a great outlet for me to do what it is I do, to be of benefit to my community and the people I'm engaging with. And it's also deeply satisfying for me to be able to exercise in authenticity, I don't know, personal challenge and growth. So I think that's probably the easiest way to answer that question.
And Catherine, you know that this podcast, speaking of themes, is centered around our ability and the game changers out there such as yourself who have the ability demonstrably in influencing and persuading and inspiring other people. I have to ask you, who inspires you today?
Today, I would say I probably have to give that honor to my son. And There's a multifaceted answer to it, but let me just give you a nugget, and this can be our next conversation, whether on or offline. As a parent, that our kids bring great lessons to us. And they also bring forward-looking lessons. Like when we're in our 20s and 30s, it's very easy to look ahead and see the impact we can have. And as we, I think we get comfortable in ways in which we're empowered in the wisdom we have, it becomes easier to stay in that space and to lose sight of what the future can look like. So my son has brought me so many gifts, both in how he sees the world and thinks about it. And he's got this incredibly creative mind. So he says and things that are so opposite of the way I think. So that's just a delight. He also, as any parent will know, holds up a pretty hard mirror. I hear me coming out of him sometimes, and sometimes I'm really proud and other times I'm not so proud. So I have to go back and do a little work. And the other thing is that has been really important in my growth is we're an adoptive family. So beyond understanding what is it like to be an LGBTQ identified family and parent, our son is adopted and he is mixed race. So my growth experience has been learning a lot about adoption, some of which is really wonderful, and a lot of which has some really hard truths connected to it that involve a lot of grief, involve a lot of trauma, and calls me to figure out how to hold some really hard things that sometimes are in competition. It also, as a white parent of a brown son, has forced me, and certainly as a white friend to many brown and black folks, has forced me to take a look at the world differently in ways that as a white person, I never had to be conscious about. And certainly my experience as a lesbian coming out helped to inform some of that. But there have been some deeper lessons that have been really important to me. And so through understanding what my role is, what I believe my role is as a responsible parent and what my son's experience is and the world I want him to live in, he's been an incredible teacher to me in that regard and inspires me to do work that is uncomfortable a lot of the time.
Well, Catherine, to me, and by the way, your son is a teenager, is that?
14, yes, indeed. So I'll call you for some advice shortly.
Oh, I don't know if you call me. Maybe call my wife, but.
Well, I believe that you are probably as an intentional parent as you are an entrepreneur and business owner. So right. I know that's credit to your wife as well, but we'll have a different conversation if you weren't as engaged as I suspect you were.
Yeah, my sons, I have three sons, and I'm very fortunate the way that they were raised and the way that they turned out. So I'm sure you're experiencing that today. And so I really appreciate this conversation that you've had with us. I appreciate your honesty. As I said at the outset, you have my utmost respect and admiration.
Thank you, Rob.
I just love what you do to make the world better, and I'm grateful that you're my friend. And we'll have to do this again. I have these kinds of conversations offline, and not wait so long to get your thoughts and your perspective out to my little world. But thank you for making us better through this conversation today.
Oh, Rob, it's been a pleasure. And again, I'm so deeply just appreciative that you've carried with me all these years and that we've been in contact. It's been one of my favorite professional relationships. I have a few where it's sort of like no one else knows this person who I really enjoy connecting with. And I just, congratulations on all that you've done, the way you've grown your business, this book that you're launching, this podcast you're doing. I'm just really proud of you and the work that you've put out there. And I'm really grateful that you're in my world. So I'm glad that the fates brought us together. Thanks for having me.
All right. All the best to your family.
Thank you. Same to you, Rob.
Curious what this diversity, equality, and inclusion specialist might understand about being a sales game changer? I invite you to join us on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform for the rest of this conversation. Catherine describes more of the meaningful work she's involved in for those who've historically felt unheard and underserved. Thanks for being a part of this episode of Game Face Execs. If you found any of it useful or helpful, please rate or like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. I always appreciate you referring us to others as well. I'll see you next week. Until then, persuade, influence, inspire.